Kia ora, Kofa Smith aho. Nau mai ki te whare, welcome to the House. In some ways, Parliament's question time can be seen as a prize-fighting boxing ring that sits at the centre of our system of responsible government. Every sitting day in Parliament's debating chamber, pugilists from a variety of weight classes face up against one another. In the blue corner, a government minister. In the red corner, an opposition MP seeking to bring them down, or at least keep them chastened. The metaphor might sound brutal, but that's kind of Parliament's job in a parliamentary democracy, keeping the government in hand and honest, and not letting them step outside of the ring of influence that Parliament, as their master, has allowed them.
Move now to question number 10, in the name of the Honourable Dr. Aisha Birrell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
It's never an easy fight, and in many ways, Parliament's rules and precedents favour government ministers in the daily stoush. There are so many rules about what can be asked and how, and so many ways to slip away, to fend, to counterpunch even. These fights tend to last many days, but opposition MPs who can find the right jabbing questions and the right combinations can sometimes release a slow stream of information that forces a minister up against the ropes.
Members, I've had a question raised to me today about the admissibility of question 10, which I want to take the opportunity to clarify our Speaker's ruling 230/4 by Speakers Wall and Smith. Once a member has made a complaint to the Speaker about a matter of privilege, it is not appropriate to raise that complaint in the House by way of notice of motion.
And when that happens, sometimes that boxer's second gets involved. On Tuesday, that was Shane Jones, who is a boxer from a heavier weight class, being Deputy Leader of New Zealand First and a long-time MP and political brawler.
This matter that you refer to, sir, a matter of privilege that may or may not be before you, how can we possibly allow questions to take place that do not violate natural justice as reflected in 231/3?
Reading between the lines, it would seem that a matter of privilege has been raised with the Speaker regarding New Zealand First MP Casey Costello. She's a government minister who has been facing increasingly punchy questions regarding her desires for tobacco regulation, which are spookily similar to the stated ambitions of a tobacco company. Matters of privilege are raised with the Speaker, and he will decide whether a question of privilege exists. And if there is a case to answer, he will refer it to the Privileges Committee, chaired by the Attorney General, Judith Collins. Usually, only at that point is it announced to the House that any complaint was made. In a way, Shane Jones is outing his own MP, apparently in an effort to protect her from further questions, like, say, this one.
Does she stand by the part of her response to the question 400, written parliamentary question 405? There was no specific document written.
Mr. Speaker, yet again, as I've stated, it was a compilation of information which was subsequently scanned by the health officials to form a document.
Shane Jones's plan, it seems, was to add impediments to the boxing stylings of Labour's Aisha Verrill, who you heard there. She's been in this particular fight all year and seems to be getting into the swing of it, so to speak.
Why did she release this single document as a document under the Official Information Act if it is, as she had just claimed, not a document?
Obviously, Shane Jones's attempts to curtail questions to Casey Costello were not successful. You have to presume that this particular boxing match has a number of rounds to go yet. And whether there is a question of privilege and what its specifics might be, well, that's also yet to be seen. Now, as it happens, Thursday's story on the House also featured Shane Jones. Parliament receives hundreds of petitions each year, and they vary enormously by topic, by the nature of the requests, and by how many people have signed them. Sometimes it's just a single person, sometimes tens of thousands. But despite the large number of petitions, they can still thrill and surprise. This week, the Petitions Committee heard a submission that threw pretty explosive new information into a legislative debate.
The documents I've just circulated are the response to an Official Information Act request that Forest and Bird received 2 days ago.
The petition was from Richard Cappy and a few thousand others on behalf of the Royal Forest and Bird Protection Society.
This response shows a list of fast-track projects may have been under consideration even during the coalition negotiations late last year, and that this information has been withheld. I'll return to this point shortly.
Petitions always ask Parliament to act, and this one is asking that the Environment Committee pause its consideration of the Fast Track Approvals Bill until the legislation is, well, complete, including the schedules listing fast track projects, schedules which are currently empty. In case you need some background, here is the Minister in charge of the Fast Track Approvals Bill, Chris Bishop, back in March when it had a first reading.
What we are doing, Mr. Speaker, is setting up a process that will put nationally and regionally significant projects in the fast lane. Projects become eligible for the fast track through one of two ways, either through a referral by the joint decision of the Ministers of Infrastructure, Regional Development and Transport upon an application, or by being listed in Schedule 2A of the bill. Once a project has been referred into the fast track, it will be considered by an expert panel, and their job is to apply the relevant consent and permit conditions.
Being slightly less generous during that same debate, Labour's Rachel Brooking.
But no, this is not just about infrastructure, Mr. Speaker. This is about mines, potentially. This is about all sorts of development that has nothing to do with the public good. And Mr. Speaker, a lot relies on what is in Schedule 2. Schedule 2 listed projects. And we see that there are no projects listed in that schedule at the moment.
And Labour's Kieran McEnulty.
If they wanted to be up front, if they were so confident that this was a better approach, they were so confident that they were happy to have public submissions in Select Committee, why on earth are those schedules not included? They are doing it deliberately, I believe, Mr. Speaker, and I think it is disgraceful.
Enough recap. Let's go back to today's presentation from Richard Cappie.
On Sunday, Minister Bishop confirmed that there are currently 384 projects under consideration. We are particularly worried about these as they could cause significant environmental harm across the country, and accordingly, they need to be properly scrutinised before they are passed into law. On Monday, the Minister reconfirmed the government's intention to provide the list of projects for Schedule 2 after the Select Committee has finished its deliberations, and this will effectively deprive the New Zealand public, you, and your parliamentary colleagues the opportunity to properly scrutinise those projects which you will then be asked to vote on.
But that wasn't the kicker in the petitioner's presentation. Cappie had received an OIA response from National MP Chris Bishop, including a draft fast-track bill that Bishop had received from New Zealand First's Shane Jones during the coalition negotiations.
It includes a schedule titled Schedule 1, Projects of National or Regional Significance. Unfortunately, as you will see in the draft, that schedule has been redacted, unreasonably in our view. It is not possible to see what that schedule contains. It clearly contains something because it was redacted, and it is reasonable to conclude that what was redacted is almost certainly a list of projects.
References to that schedule in the draft legislation do refer to it as a list of projects. So, yes. And that would also mean two things. A list of some possible fast-track projects has existed since late last year. And that list was created by New Zealand First, before they were in the government, possibly even prior to the election, and were possibly part of its negotiations. Comparing that redacted list from Shane Jones's bill to the one that hasn't yet been added to the Fast Track Approvals Bill would certainly be interesting.
I think the New Zealand Parliament should see that list of projects, should be able to see the list of projects that were put forward in this draft bill and see what overlap there is and ask good questions about probity involving that. I think New Zealanders also deserve to know what is being considered in their backyards.
Petitions always have a specific ask, and Richard Cappie's was this.
And not allow the Fast Track Approvals Bill to leave Select Committee until the final list of projects has been provided to the Environment Committee.
The Fast Track legislation is not the only environmental topic before the committees at the moment. On Wednesday, Louis Collins reported on another topic, one, oddly, before the Finance and Expenditure Committee.
Climate change is a pretty ubiquitous topic in Parliament. It's the subject of so many debates and conversations in the House, which tend to get pretty heated at the best of times. In days of old, those debates may have contained arguments like, climate change exists, and we need to stop it. While that's still the case, for a few years now we've been seeing increasing dialogue, not about how we can stop it, but how on earth we can live with it. Recent extreme weather events like Cyclone Gabriel and the Auckland anniversary floods are jarring reminders that inaction would be chaotic and adaptation is critical. In what seems like a rare instance of bipartisan collaboration and consensus at Parliament, the Finance and Expenditure Committee are currently conducting an inquiry into climate adaptation. Today, they heard from the Climate Change Commission. Here's Dr. Rod Carr, who chairs the commission, and Stephen Walter, who works in its Emissions Budgets and Adaptation Division.
It's in New Zealand's own interests to reduce our emissions from how we live our lives and the products and services we produce. It is also inevitable that human activity has caused the change in climate. The climate is the one we will have to learn to live with. And the Commission's monitoring of progress and adaption is to help all New Zealanders understand whether we are best dressed for the future.
And what have you just told the committee?
Well, what we've told the committee is that there are a number of key considerations. One of the foremost ones is this is likely to be the most difficult challenge that this country faces over the next century. A big part of that will be trying to find out, first of all, how we allocate the costs in a manner that's fair, but also how we find the quantum of funding that's necessary to adapt to climate change. A critical component of that is cross-party support. So we're very grateful that that Parliament has formed this cross-party committee inquiring into an adaptation framework. It's really important that there's cross-party support not just on the outcome that we achieve, but also on the actions and measures we take in support of that outcome.
If it is not clear to households and businesses where costs and losses will lie, that they will not make the optimum choices about where to live and what to produce and what risks to avoid. So we were very clear with the Finance and Expenditure Committee that the matter of where costs and losses lie is critical to good choices being made.
The words climate adaptation are reasonably broad. Here is the committee chair and National MP for Kaikoura, Stuart Smith, who explained to me the scope of the committee's inquiry.
Well, we're looking into adaptation, and so we've had a number of submitters on that issue, and we've had the Climate Change Commission in this morning as well. And the question is really around how do we adapt to the changing climate? How do we adapt to flooding events, those sorts of things? There's a lot of interesting stuff come out of it. I mean, I think there's some pretty simple things that can be done.
Now, I'll ask you a two-pronged question. You said, I remind listeners, you said you were the chair of the Finance and Expenditure Committee. What's that committee doing? Sort of, you'd think it'd be an environmental committee matter. Why are they looking into it?
Because ultimately, it's a good question, by the way, but ultimately it is a finance question because these things will cost money. And the question often will come down to where do the costs fall and who pays for them.
And so I presume you would have been hearing from, in your submissions, from insurance companies and sort of invested stakeholders, is that right?
Insurance companies, regional councils, all sorts of groups have come before the committee. It's been really helpful, actually. Every one of them has a different take, slightly. So it's been interesting.
And for those that don't know, what actually is the purpose of an inquiry and what happens with it when you've finished?
Well, I think it's my hope anyway, it will feed into a climate adaptation bill.
Has it been helpful using a cross-party institution like a select committee to do this work?
Well, this is a bipartisan inquiry. All the parties are collaborating and actually it's working really well. And ultimately, even in the adaptation space, there will be things that we disagree on party lines, but the thing is to find the maximum amount of things that we can agree on so that we can make progress, because governments come and go. This is a long-term issue, a very long-term issue, and so it's something we have to do. Ultimately, as I said, we built most of our towns and cities on river deltas. So
yeah, swamps.
Exactly.
Like Christchurch, exactly.
But the question is, do we actually mitigate that now and try and stop the flooding, or do we at some point say, well, we have to retreat from that area? And so we're looking at how do you come up with a framework to make those decisions, who makes those decisions, then come up with a framework about who pays for those decisions.
E te whakarongo koe ki te whare. You've been listening to The House, a program made with funding from Parliament's Office of the Clerk. Mā te wā.